becomes a lot easier and a lot faster when you completely surrender and just try relentlessly to be authentic for 24 hours at a time. And the number one performance blocker is fear. And that unaddressed fear is always linked to some sort of shame. Then put a medal on your chest and think, well, if I work harder and I chase perfection and I leave no stone unturned, then I'll be enough. And you always realize you're on this journey and you never find belonging, you never find enough, you never find that tip of the mountain you're looking for. All of a sudden we create authentic connection. We're sharing vulnerability, because vulnerability, Brian, is honesty. Honesty is truth. Truth is authenticity. Authenticity gets us to connection, and connection's what gets us to fulfillment and what I deem as high performance. It's toxic behavior when you're trying to give a message but you're not being the message.
Hey, I hope you're keeping well. I'm Brian Moylett, former rugby player, now mindset and performance coach. And welcome to the pod. This podcast is about well-being and high performance. And in it, you will learn how you can be happier, more fulfilled, and more successful. I recently wrote the book on how to become a pro rugby player, forward by Robbie Henshaw, which went to number one in the charts, and you can get this now on Amazon and Audible, with the links in the show notes. Please connect with me now over on social media at Brian Moylett and at Offfield Rugby. If you enjoyed the pod, please subscribe to it, leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening now. And also, you can send it on to some friends. Would really appreciate that. All right, we'll get into today's episode. Cheers. Hey, hope you're keeping well. Today, I'm chatting with Rick Cooper, and just chatting beforehand. It's been a while coming. I suppose we connected, what, about 2 years ago, probably on LinkedIn, I would say, and I just saw some cool posts that, yeah, you were putting up around personal development, and it's been cool following your journey and just being in touch online, I suppose. And tried to do this a couple of times, but delighted to be here. I suppose, would you just give a bit of an introduction around your kind of background and what you're up to now?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for holding the space. My man, like we say, it has been a long time coming. My background, I guess, starting from the beginning, high level rugby player until injury struck. And then trying to navigate my way in the world after that, having only dreamt of ever being a professional rugby player, having that taken away from me by injury at 2021 was a big shock to the system, and trying to find who I was and trying to initiate a new identity. It led me to join the fire service in London for 10 years, becoming an officer in that process, going back to play semi-pro again as well. I'm breaking everything else over 6 or 7 years. So nose, jaw, hand, shoulders, ankles. And after leaving rugby, there's still some untreated significance within me that just kept still driving to try and achieve, specifically in sport, which led me to boxing for the ABA and weightlifting or powerlifting for Great Britain. And then into educating around strength and conditioning. And then 6 years ago, decided that I realised my calling was actually in coaching others in leadership and performance. And it led me to now being able to deliver workshops in the independent school circuit and work one-to-one with people in sport and corporate and education. And you suddenly realise your whole life's path has been navigating itself to the now, as it always is.
Yeah, that's so funny and so true, what you just said there. Seeing that your whole life's path navigates you to where you are now, and kind of how everything is necessary.
Yeah. So I don't know if it comes with age, Brian, but it's certainly the willingness now to just surrender. And it's definitely not been a part of my life until recent years, is understanding that fear informs control, and there's always an underpinning shame under fear, and control instigates force in life to make the world work for you. When in actual fact, it never is that way. It comes a lot easier and a lot faster when you completely surrender and just try relentlessly to be authentic for 24 hours at a time. As exhausting as that is, the surrender is the constant challenge, I think, every day.
Yeah, 100%. That's something I'm understand recently, and the the surrender. It's difficult, isn't it? Because I think, like, your background, like what you said there, I played rugby as well, and just kind of you get conditioned to like push, and I think you get, you know, you do get rewards that, like, you know, push harder in the gym, you'll get stronger, and you just get conditioned to kind of push. But yeah, chat to me about surrender, how you found that.
Yeah, it's pretty real recent, more than it has been this last 6 months. I started learning lots about emotional intelligence, and I think from delving into myself and realizing the number one performance blocker is fear. And that unaddressed fear is always linked to some sort of shame, and putting a lens all over that for me personally was one of those eureka moments where you realize you've gathered obviously shame you cannot instigate positive change from, because the attachment to self and I, rather than healthy guilt, which is the behavior. And when I put the lens on fear, I am getting to surrender, by the way. When I put the lens on fear of my own journey, it was when I'd been told in my teenage years, oh, you're not strong enough, you're not fast enough, you're too lazy, or you're too energetic. Don't make a mistake, you're X, Y, Z. And then realizing that actually all the joy and the fun and the ability to be present at their moments was because I then had the underbelly of shame of, I'm not good enough, I'm not enough, which is hard to instigate positive change from, because then you try to force the world to work for you. You don't realize you're in shame. You just then put a medal on your chest and think, well, if I work harder and I chase perfection and I leave no stone unturned, then I'll be enough. And you always realize you're on this journey and you never find belonging, you never find enough, you never find that tip of the mountain you're looking for. And I think it was once I could put a lens on all this and realize that I'd had some extremely unemotionally intelligent coaches, teachers within my life who gave me them labels, the attachment to self, you're not good enough, you're not strong enough, you're too energetic. No one actually sat down and said, with any emotional intelligence, pulled me to one side and said, at the moment, Rick, when you take contact, we feel like we could get you a bit stronger there to make sure you can benefit from that contact area, and probably be a bit more dominant so we can win the ball in them areas. Because that way we get healthy guilt of, okay, it's not an attachment to self, it's an attachment to the behavior. The same as, you're disruptive. Well, actually, you're not disruptive. If we had an emotionally intelligent leader say to me, for instance, Rick, in this class, I realized that you're not engaged as much, and I know you like to try and get someone else's attention. What can I do to make you feel more engaged? What learning model do you find best? Because I really want to engage you and I realize it's me. All of a sudden, then we change the aspect of how I carry that forward, for instance. And I think that's where I've come to learn about surrender, is I've been able to look through a lens and realize that my own shame was tied in self and I, but actually it never was. It was someone else's unconscious projection of their own shame and fear onto me. They didn't know how to communicate that across. And I'd carried that for nearly 20 years and then been like, that's not me. They're all behaviors of that time under someone else's perspective. And then looking and going, well, authentically then, who am I? And asking them deep questions of myself, and having like seven sort of woo-woo as it sounds, Brian, like them I am statements that I got to, where you detach the ego from the self and then the humility, the triangle. And I think it was being able to look at my ego and be like, I know I'm really competitive, but I always thought that was my ego, not my true self. I've always known I'm really driven, and I've tried to bury that as well and believe that's the ego in me. But I know I'm energetic, I know I'm passionate, I know I'm courageous, I know I'm very sensitive, and I know I'm really compassionate. And all of a sudden, putting the lens on all of this was like, holy, you know, shitballs. This is my true self. And actually, the ego is the part of me that keeps telling me, you're a perfectionist, you're not good enough. You know, all these other things are trying to keep me, pulling me down into this trap. And that was when it was like, I just need to surrender. If I know who I really am, what my self is, then I realise I have no control. There's a bigger universal energy out there that I've got no control over, whether we call it God or faith. And actually, if I just surrender to being completely all in to myself, them statements, I don't know if I'm going to be here tomorrow. So I just need to surrender to all of that and stay completely true to my own authenticity. I guess that's the short answer of that journey that I've been on and lead others on. But yeah, I'll let you pick the bones on some of that.
Wow, incredible. Love it. Yeah, so much there. The going back to the first thing, what you mentioned about coaches and leaders, it's so interesting in what you said there about them putting their fears and worries onto you. So say in the classroom, it would have been you're being energetic and it sounds like you're like me. And then they start telling you all that stuff and their fear and worry is that their class gets out of control, quote unquote, and that their headmaster sees, might walk by and not see 30 kids sitting down quiet, just with their heads down, you know, that it's not perfect in what they deem perfect to be. Or if it's on the rugby field, like you said, about a coach saying you're not strong enough, you're not this, that, the other, is, yeah, potentially a fear of them losing games and them once not, I suppose, yeah, not just not, I suppose, not being aware of how to, yeah, the, not having the emotional intelligence, like you say, to help you improve, and that kind of labeling.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'd say that I haven't got the emotional intelligence. I have massive empathy because it's not in any coaching program. You know, I'm only a level two rugby coach that I gained years ago, but no one ever teaches you about emotional intelligence. So coaches go out in the world and they learn a lot about the game and tactics and strategies and skill. Mm. But there's always this big, massive chunk of emotional intelligence that's always left out. And like you said there, for this is where empathy comes in as well, and identification from teachers and coaches to players, is their fear is that, oh God, I'm going to be judged. The headmaster walked past and I'm judged on my performance within this classroom, and if I don't look like I can control this class, how's that going to look for me? So there becomes a fear. It becomes an unconscious fear of shame. I cannot, I've got no control. I'm out of control, which means I'm not good enough. So then it cascades in this loop and then comes out when I said about fear and control. So what does a teacher do? Through fear, we try to control even more. So then through that fear, it's we remove people from the class, like in my instance, or we label them and tell them they're disruptive, and then they get sent to the headmaster because basically the teacher's coming from fear that wants to exert control. Whereas if we have more empathy and identification, that teacher would sit there and go, Rick, I realise, you know, all these things. I've also been that person. I've also been in a room with someone that I couldn't engage with and maybe not found it as engaging and as fun as I would have liked. And I realised back then all I wanted was someone to come to me and be like, how can I make this more interesting for you? And I want to do that for you. All of a sudden we create authentic connection. We're sharing vulnerability because vulnerability, Brian, is honesty. Honesty is truth. Truth is authenticity. Authenticity gets us to connection, and connection's what gets us to fulfillment and what I deem as high performance. But it's like gold dust out there, you know, like, because people think to be vulnerable is to show weakness, and it truly isn't. If people knew that vulnerability was honesty, and then realize that when they say, yeah, I'm an honest person, and then you ask, well, can you be vulnerable? Well, no, because that's weakness. Well, then you're a dishonest person. I don't trust you. And it's like, oh, wow, that hit quite hard. I think it just comes down to that, and we see this in sport. I know you're very close to it, and I'll just talk from my experiences, but I see this a lot in coaches when I observe from the sidelines and watch behavior. It's this domineering need to control because we have this deep sense of self and deep sense of worth in the coach is based on the results and the performance of the team. And if the team, that then gets projected, I generally believe that teams are a mirror of their coach, their leadership team. And if the coach has a fear, what I tend to see is he talks about the opposition, which unconsciously tells the rest of his players, whether they realise it or not, I don't trust myself, I don't trust you, which is why we have to look and analyse the opposition. We have a game plan, but we're also going to study and analyse them. So all of a sudden, the coach is, I'm scared. I'm scared we're going to lose. I'm scared if we lose, I'm going to be judged on this loss. If you don't perform, people, what are people going to think of me? Whereas if I had more coaches that said, this is our style of play, this is our game plan, we don't need to think of anyone else because that's time, energy and emotion outside of our environment. Let's just get really good at what we do, regardless of who we're in front of, because I trust you, I trust myself, and I trust my knowledge in this game plan that I'm trying to execute with you. I'm also really scared, guys or girls, about losing. Do you feel that fear as well? Yes, of course I do. Okay, good. But I trust you. Do you trust me? Oh God, yes I do. And then it's like, wow, imagine the connection if we get that within that environment. And then that's authenticity then. And that's deep, meaningful relationships that are willing to run through walls and go the extra mile emotionally and physically for everybody in that environment. But no, but it's really rare to find an emotionally intelligent coach that holds that sense of self that can deliver that message.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And it's so interesting you're speaking there about the opposition. And I've had it a couple of times recently. Working one-on-one with players or kind of like first call with a player, you know, a new player, like a introductory call, and they'll be talking and talking, and I'll be trying to discover like what it is, trying to understand what it is that's holding them back. And fear of, I've seen a couple times recently, fear of the coach, like just talking about the opposition so much, and like, we have to do this or they'll that. And it's like, if these younger players are just petrified.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think Johnny Wilkinson said in a podcast, the High Performance podcast, that it's toxic behavior when you're trying to give a message, but you're not being the message. It's almost saying that this is the game plan on a Tuesday night or a Monday morning. Here's our game plan. Here's us analysing the opposition. And then the message is, but boys, I just want you to be free. Girls, I just want you to just unleash your potential. It's almost like, well, how can I? You just put all these, just because through your need to control the outcome Saturday or Sunday, you've put more strategies in place. We've looked at more details. You've thrown the opposition in within that details. You've unconsciously created a training week around the fact they've got, I don't know, like a strong centre and a brilliant number eight. And now you've told us that this is what we're going to do in these areas. Well, how can I expose my potential and play with any freedom when you've unconsciously put a seed in my brain that these are the things I need to be looking for? You know, and that's what I mean. Do you know what I mean, Brian? And then so when you work one-to-one with the player, it's like, you know, where did you find my joy as a child? How would you like your life to be? What would it look like on a rugby field, a football field, whatever it is, in your most free-flowing state? When we find that's like our dream life, it's like, let's live that. Like, your professional life then becomes work life, right? Expressive, expansive, free, spacious, innovative, brave, courageous. But yeah, I'm a big believer in the more I observe, the more I realise that the teams and players are a mirror of the leadership. Football's a good one. I think Man City, Liverpool, Tottenham at the moment, you've got really deeply emotionally intelligent coaches at them three clubs. Scott Robertson in the Griffith Crusaders, it's all very spiritual, all talk, never about tactics, always about something deep within, an identity and a sense of self. And I've referenced that so many times I've watched in the interviews, that there's very little said on tactics and strategy.
Yeah. It's so true, yeah, you say about the players mimicking the leader. I saw that first when I was watching The Last Dance, started to understand it first when I watched The Last Dance with Michael Jordan and the Bulls, and Phil Jackson spoke about Dennis Rodman, and if he was animated on the sideline, Dennis would be going, getting animated, and he realized that he had to be calm, so then Dennis would be calm. And something I spoke with two people on this podcast about neurodiversity, and I can't remember which podcast it was, but they said that neurodiverse people can often take on the emotional energy of the other person. So if someone, if they go into a room and three people are really energetic and excited, they can start to get that, or they, and whereas if the other person is calm, they can be calm. Start to do that. And I suppose it is in general, yeah, for sure, with teams, but it was interesting the person saying that. And I think that holds weight also, in that if you are a leader, by you being calm and relaxed, if you're holding space with someone, it will help them get to be like you, you know?
Mm. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I do really believe in coaches having empathy for their players. And what empathy means, in suffering or in feeling, with its Latin, by Latin origin. And I think coaches just, for some reason, there's just this lack of empathy, a lack of identification, and a need to hang people out to dry. Yeah, and I do feel that. And it's who the coach is being in the world as well. Okay, how strong is their sense of self, and not let their ego take over. I mean, I don't want to keep referencing it. We see in the Premiership with Ten Hag at Man United and Marcus Rashford, and you saw the recent interview that Rashford's given, when he talks about sitting in the stadium and he feels deeply connected in the stadium, and he used the word, I think you'll probably think I'm weird, but sometimes I like to come into Old Trafford on my own, and the more I come here, the more safe I feel and the more at home I feel. And yeah, and he says, I love it here, it's where I express. But and then he says to the interviewer, you probably think I'm strange. And you listen to all these words that he's telling the interviewer, and he's crying for someone like Ten Hag to grab him and say, oh, listen to the words you've used. And you know, I feel that sometimes. Will you take me to the stadium with you? And can we just sit there in silence so I can feel all that as well? And let me see what I actually feel as well. And you, all you see is someone like Ten Hag look at these expressive, expansive, spacious individuals, the Ronaldo, the Rashford, the Jadon Sancho, who have such a strong sense of self, that what he tries to do, he goes, I'm scared. My sense of worth is built into my management. If I don't look like I can control you, then it looks bad on me. It looks bad on my ability to run a club. So what I'll do is make you train the reserves. I'll drop you and you'll sit on a subs bench, and I won't invite you back into the first team because I'm so scared that you know who you are and I can't negotiate with you on that. And that makes me fearful. So what I'll do is I'll try to control you through fear, where his own shame is not being looked at all, and how he moves through the world in who he bees gets completely lost in translation with his players. And like so wow. You say, is that deep sense of self and spirituality with oneself, like Phil Jackson in basketball's got it in abundance, and then what you then project from that in energy, in words, from where that center and that real strong sense self of is, starts to make the whole being. And that feeds and drip feeds to all the players, all the team. And what a special environment when you do get such an emotionally in touch, authentic leader.
Yeah, incredible. Jeez, I'm a United fan. I hadn't heard about that recently with Rashford. And that's so interesting what you just said there. Yeah. And with how it looks, yeah, from the outside with Ten Hag wanting to control everything. And if someone steps outside, then, yeah, that they might get banished or whatever. Something I found out in the last year, which I found so, so powerful, is naming your emotions. So got a sheet with like 50 emotions and they're linked to needs. And it's like, before that, I would have been like, oh, I'm feeling good, feeling all right, feeling pretty shit, feeling great. You know, those are if someone asked me, if I was to really sit there and someone asked me and I gave back an honest answer, that's what I would have been saying. But when you start to, when you have all the emotions there, because, and you can see them on a piece of paper, and then you sit with how you're feeling, like what you said with Rashford sitting in the stadium, or like any of us sitting at any time in our life, be it in work, be it in the car, be it in whatever. And when you sit there and really feel into your body, into your belly, into your gut, and really sit, and it's like, what am I feeling? And you connect with that feeling. it's so powerful on many, many levels, because first up with the, you get to understand it. And then with the, we'll say, quote unquote, negative, you know, the emotions that you don't like feeling so much, they go when you sit with them and connect with them. They dissipate by and large, whereas when we're not aware of them, we just reach for the vice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, bro, I love that. I love what you've just said there. It's so true. We do. If we don't stop to name them, we numb them.
Mm.
That's a love what you just said there. Yeah, the naming. We can write it or say it or talk it. Like shame breeds in silence, doesn't it? So if we keep numbing it and keep it quiet, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And the shame comes to projection. It's so important to name it. Like, I am scared. What am I scared of? What do I feel? I'm angry. That anger makes me feel scared. I'm scared, and then I become frustrated because I'm scared. Why am I that? And as soon as we can write that down and just get it out, voice it to somebody, it's all of a sudden shame is dead. It can't breathe anymore. It doesn't know what to do. It's so important. I love that you brought that up.
Yeah, and with going back, you mentioned at the start with fear and maybe shame, but it reminded me, I was chatting with a player over Zoom, and we were chatting, and then towards the end, it's funny, the longer you go on a call, the more authentic it becomes, or the more it flows. It's the same with anything, same with a podcast, it's the same with anything, like the more it flows as you sit there. And towards the end, we're just chatting, and the player wants to get to a certain level and wants to play, you know, achieve a certain amount, and that's great, you know, have a North Star, something that you're working towards. And what we kind of uncovered, the player then was like, oh, there's a block, and it's like, oh well, I'm essentially, if I don't get there, then these people will think this, and they'll be like, oh well, why didn't he get there, and he shouldn't have tried, and so all that was within him, and that fear and worry. And what it was 10 minutes over the call, and I had to go to another meeting. But I was kind of saying to him, wow, this is powerful. All right, journal, write down, start journaling about that. Sit with it, put your phone away for a while, give yourself time and space, and just write about that. Like, why does that worry you? Why are you afraid of that? And to go deeper within that. And I would have been the exact same when I was younger. You worry about what other people think if you don't succeed. And the insecurity there, when you can free yourself of that insecurity, wow, you get free. It is so freeing.
Yeah. Yeah, hugely, hugely. Just sitting in that, because something came to me a moment ago, Brian, you said we've got that healthy drive, that healthy selfishness for something bigger than ourselves. It is so important. I think that underpins that massive competitiveness that many of us involved in sport have, is that it does come with some sort of healthy selfishness. And I think somewhere, I mean, I work a lot with young athletes, and at some point, normally about 14 to 17, when they find joy in sport to be all about connection, expression, them authentically expressing themselves. I think the first bite for many of us comes when someone goes, you're not taking it seriously enough. And it's like, oh, and nearly every athlete I've worked with, the young one, suddenly feels the pressure from that moment. Oh, so I now need to worry what someone else is thinking of me. I can't get to where I want to go now because I'm deemed to be this. So I better start now shutting down. I better not show that I enjoy this. I better not show that I really want to have fun with my friends while I'm here. I better now bury them emotions and feelings. I better numb who I really am to now please those that are leading me if I want this potential to flourish. And I think from that young age, when we get to then professionalism, we become so orientated on what will X, Y, and Z think of me if I do this? What will X, Y, and Z think of me if I'm seen to be this way? And all of a sudden, it takes us further and further from our authentic self. I know that's a word that gets pushed around a lot, authenticity, but we get further and further from our truth.
Hmm. Yeah, the more we worry about, what other people think, absolutely, we get, you're right, further and further from who we actually are, because we do things and live our lives to, not on our terms, it just...
Yeah. And we lose connection with self. And if we lose connection with self, we've not really got meaningful, authentic relationships around us, or honest relationship around us, because there's that old saying, Brian, isn't there, that you're the average of the five people you surround yourself with. And I always challenge that, because I always feel like if you say I'm the average of the five people I surround myself with, I'm outsourcing. But what if they're the average of you? You're the mirror. Them five people are magnets to your energy. They're called to you because of who you're being in the world, or I'm being in the world. And all of a sudden now it's on me. So if I don't feel like I can connect to them people on a really deep level to express who I am, and to perform at our highest standards as a team, because we've got this missing connection, then maybe it's me that's not sitting in my truth. Maybe it's me that's not being honest or vulnerable, honest, the same thing, with myself, to be so close to my truth and my authenticity that it's not them at all, it's myself. And then when we get closer to that, we get completely empowered, Brian, because it's, wow, I'm authentic. And when we're authentic, we can start to feel that we belong, because belonging comes from self. We can be belonging and be anywhere. Whereas if we're trying to fit in, which we mistake for belonging a lot, fitting in is, let me survey my environment quickly and see who I need to be to make sure that I fit into this environment. Well, they're the complete opposites. And when we try to fit in, we lose who we are. And then we start to worry what other people think of us and what we need to do to get to fit in. I know it's a minefield. I'm sure we could talk for hours on each of these subjects. But it's really important. I think for young people, young athletes who are, trying to get as far as they can in their careers. For me personally, it is, what's the performance blocker? It's fear. Let's dive into all these subjects. And put a lens on all of them in a corner to the individual to really release them. I mean, ironically, as soon as you release them into full expression, not only are they performing at the top level, they experience so much more fulfillment in their private life as well, and more connection. And I think they feel so enough empowerment to have an element of healthy disrespect, smile when someone questions something, realize, they don't even know themselves. That coach doesn't even know who they are. You've got no right, but I'll nod and smile because I'll be here and I'll keep producing the goods because I'm free and I know who I am. Now, it takes a lot of courage, but you can't have courage without vulnerability. They're not mutually exclusive. They're together. There is no courage without vulnerability. You can't dare greatly without being vulnerable. And vulnerability and courage live together.
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah, you're reminded me there when you were speaking of Danny Cipriani started saying stuff on, was it Twitter or Instagram, about coaching and how English rugby, how it sets up its coaching and the type of people it has within it. And he said that someone like Sean Edwards, when he was 19 coming into Wasps, he just said how Sean Edwards, like, understood him and cared about him as a person, and was, yeah, just a very caring coach. And then he said how that would never fit in with the English mold, with the English rugby mold. And Sean Edwards, like Sean, or from what I've seen, then I don't know, I'm not him, but I think he wanted to get back into the England setup, or at times, you know, like he'd be, because he was definitely the best defence coach in the world, is still one of the best defence coaches in the world, and for all those years, and it was like, he's English. Why is he coach? Okay, he's coaching Wales, he's with Gatland, but, and then someone like Danny Cipriani, yeah, a controlling coach. Of course, Eddie Jones wouldn't have him. Like, you know, like, like.
That's like, yeah. You
know? Oh, stop. Yeah.
But can you see it now, Brian? Like,
yeah,
we're talking about all this now, like the fear, the control, the underpinning shame, like the ego, the self, like even us laughing now, it's because all of a sudden we're like, fuck yeah, you can see all this in Eddie now. You can see it in Borthwick to a degree. You can see it like across the board in all these people where it's like, fuck. But now you can see why some of the best talents in the land in England don't get that look in. Because the English mentality is like, we've stayed rooted to this rigid game plan for donkey's years, and we apply coaches that fall in line with that, because it's like, well, we'll tell you who to be because you don't know who you are, and you're willing to bend who you are to take this position. And now they feel all that fear unconsciously. They pass it on to players and make selections based on that. So we've seen some of the best talents we've ever produced not be put on that stage.
Yeah. 100%. And then if you want to, with the fear and control, I used to like Eddie Jones, to be honest, just with how he was in the media. I found it very theatrical. I found it the way he would not care. Like he's like, I used to like the way he kind of didn't give a fuck, and he'd go at the media, and I enjoyed watching that kind of, we'll say, that pantomime, and how he kind of went toe-to-toe with them. And I enjoyed that spectacle. And so, look, I enjoyed that. But then, you know, now that I know more, and if we just on that fear and control, he then obviously went to Australia, didn't pick Quade Cooper. You know, like, and you know, and brought one kid out half who I think is a great talent, but then, you know, one inexperienced out half with three or four caps, and then didn't bring Michael Hooper as well, who's like a spiritual leader within that team. Like he's the man, you know, he has been the man for Australia for years, and like not bringing him, so you know, potentially anyone who could have a say or who could have an opinion on something, it seemed like just turf them, so that he could control 100%.
And then you see the inconsistencies of the World Cup, where the young lad he picked plays all his club rugby at 15, and he plays 15 for Australia, then gets dropped, and then Eddie puts him at 10 and then drops him again. And you start to see now a man that's, I mean, I really do hope, and I've heard that he's left Australia, gone to Japan, and apparently I've heard that he's started talking about his spirituality and God and faith again, which are all sure signs that he's realised, oh God, I've lost who I was. I need to come back to realise there's something way bigger here. I need to check in with myself. Now I'm back in Japan, because you realise that when a coach has lost or in touch with who he really is, he starts making decisions from complete fear. And then you look at the environment, and you have a young lad who plays 15 in all of Australian rugby that gets dropped, then gets put in a pivotal position at 10 and gets dropped off the back of one bad performance, put on the bench, and then put on again with 10 minutes to go to try and save the game. That player's mind is shot to pieces. because he doesn't feel safe. He doesn't feel he's belong. He's got a coach who doesn't, he's sending a message but not being the message. And it then comes a surprise of the collapse of that Australian team squad that went to the World Cup. It is, you know, Eddie was out of touch with what his message was and who he was being was completely incongruent. I'm not in the camp. I'm just obviously observing from the outset. And like yourself, someone that's, you know, as a student of the psychology and, you know, human performance and human behavior, and you're watching from the outside in, for me, it seemed abundantly clear what was going on. Yeah, I do laugh at Quade Cooper. He's one of my favourite players of all time. And it's just like, what a shame to not see him on that stage.
Yeah, me too. And I would think like, look, if I were the Australian coach, but like, you know, you go in there and you put Quade Cooper 10, like he went, Australia were struggling. Like, to be honest, they weren't struggling as much as after he left or the way he made them look, because we forget that under Dave Rennie, they could have, would have, should have beat New Zealand. Remember, they didn't kick the ball out. Like they would have beaten the All Blacks on that day, a year before Eddie took over. And then they had a couple of other close, narrow defeats to top nations. We'll put it this way, essentially. They practically beat the All Blacks a year before, who got to the World Cup final, who lost by a hair with 14 men. You know, so that's how the Australian team was under Rennie. And then, if you go in, it's like, you got Quade Cooper, you got Michael Hooper, you've got these guys, and you have them there with that experience, that manner. Like, they definitely have the respect, I would imagine, of the players, because of those younger players. Like, I would imagine those younger players look up to those guys. And you try and create an environment, and those players lead and they drive that team, and you facilitate that team and try and bring up other leaders like Will Skelton. And, you know, you try and find a few more. Forget his name, but the hooker, they've a couple of front rowers who have a lot of caps. And yeah, essentially you try and facilitate that. Whereas he just kind of, turfed out the two biggest voices within the team. And it's funny how it just, Eddie says as well himself, or said himself, the results are the outcome, or the outcomes give you they tell you how it is. Or in sports, it's like the game is the answer, the game is shows you how it is. And like, wow, did they completely just fall apart?
And I generally believe, Brian, that was a perfect scenario of the team mirrors the leadership. Perfect synopsis that was, in playing out right in front of our eyes.
Yeah. And it is interesting then, isn't it? Like then that he gets the Japan job.
Yeah. And I'm, you know his connections with the president and all the rest of it. And we know the world. It's not what you know, it's who you know. It's just the way the world works. So much talent gets pushed to one side because of that, on that basis. But again, it comes down to people in those higher end positions, fear and control. I'll take who I know, because my sense of self and sense of worth is tied up here in what will people think of me. If I show bravery and courage and dare greatly to innovate, it's so scary to do that. So it's, well, let's stick with what we know. I can control this.
Yeah. So true. Yeah. And going back, in England, it looks a bit like that too.
Yeah, I think that, thankfully, I'm going to, come on, it's the Six Nations, well, definitely the second half of Six Nations is an England team that, and I have been critical of the approach up until after that Scotland game, when all of a sudden it looked like it was, right, do you know what, if you want, like anyone, if we want to find our true self and our identity, it's always going to be an elimination process, not an add-in. And it generally felt like someone within that England setup just said, right, let's take all this away. We're going to get Felix Jones and a blitz defence, which is, you know, I'm not a defence coach, but, you know, it's extremely effective. You know, squash space as quick as you can. Brilliant. When we've got the ball, just take away all the strategy. Let's just play with freedom. I've got faith in you. You can make mistakes. This is an environment you're allowed to make mistakes and just go for it. And I think that's pretty much what we saw in them last three games with England, that actually if they played that way the whole time, we're potentially looking at Six Nations winners. If that was embedded, that belief system in the coaching staff was probably brought in at the start of his tenure. But I'd imagine that the leadership there has suddenly sat there and gone, do you know what? Times have changed. We've got a player pool in this country way vaster than any other nation in the world. That club rugby are playing fast, expansive, expressive rugby, and they come to national camp and we're putting the clippers on them. Well, this, something's got to change. Let's just go for it. What have we got to lose now? And that's generally what it felt like that happened. And it was so pleasing to be an England supporter again in them last three games. Just watching just really exciting, expressive rugby. Like, wow.
And it's interesting, the England-Ireland game, with chatting to a friend of mine who just started following rugby 2 or 3 years ago or whatever, and he was like, oh, what do you think? You're going to back-to-back Grand Slams. And I said to him, oh, England at Twickenham, you know, never easy. And another one is, and this is just, look, hindsight as well, but with when someone's at their lowest ebb, that's always a chance for the rise of the Phoenix or a real massive change and a massive transformation. And when someone's at their highest ebb, you know, there's always that chance of complacency. And I feel that's what happened. Like Ireland, I remember in New Zealand, I used to put a few bets on when I was younger. I haven't in about 8 or 9 years, thankfully. But because I moved to the States where you couldn't, and then it was like, oh, so I just got out of it. But on New Zealand here, there's an app called Tribe, and it has all the fixtures and results and of every sport and everything. So I love it. You just check Premier League football and the rugby and all around the world, and a bit of basketball, whatever. But they put the odds on it, and England were 5-1. Or else, yeah, $5 or 4-1 or 5-1. I'm not sure how the odds work, but like way outsiders, you know, like that's how much of an underdog they were. And it's, I think it's always when you're at, there's, like you said as well about taking off the handbrake and just saying, all right, well, fuck it. Can't get much worse. Or, you know, and so take off the handbrake, you know, and just let rip. And it looked like that in that England-Ireland game. Like they ripped into Ireland from minute one and they just went at them, you know, and it was interesting. I think it's a great, not say Ireland were complacent, look, they lost to an England team that played really, really well, but it's interesting. Yeah. And I think that's also for individuals too. It's like when you're at a low moment as well, it's always darkest before the dawn, and you know, you can always bounce back as well.
Yeah. There's you probably know about this, Brian, anyway, but like it's that metacognitive bias of moving towards or moving away. And I think that it looked very much like when you're at rock bottom, I think you become like you said, the rise of a phoenix is, if you've got a good, strong leadership team or group that sit there and go, actually, who do we want to be? Like, we're down here now. It can't feel any worse. Mm. Let's get really clear on where we want to go. And I think when you get to the top or you're in that messy middle, it's easy to think you're going somewhere, but you're actually in a moving away metacognitive bias, because you can convince ourselves you're moving forwards, but actually you're not. We become rigid, unexpressive. Whilst looking forward, you're continually looking over your shoulder to not make mistakes or not get caught. I think the simplest way I can describe that is, it's like a rugby team saying we're winners, we win. And then you get to 7 minutes to go and the score's like, I don't know, 12-10. And all of a sudden you ask any rugby player or any rugby team, well, how do you play? What do you mean? When you're 12-10 up with 7 minutes to go, how do you start playing rugby? Oh, well, we keep it tight. We make sure we close down their line like quickly, not giving away any penalties. Blah, blah. So are you planning to win then? Or are you actually planning not to lose? And you have that epiphany with them. They go, oh, yeah, but we play to... Well, they're not behaviours to play to win. That's a metacognitive bias of moving away from losing. So all your behaviours represent not losing. You do everything to avoid not losing. You're convincing yourself that you're trying to win, but you're not. So how can you call yourself a team that wins and winners if you're not willing to put your foot on the throat of the opposition for the full 80 minutes, 90 minutes, whatever the game is, to win? Because then this is where you show proof then of, do we believe in the game plan? Do we trust the coach's message? Do we trust who the coach is? Do we trust ourselves? If we do trust all that and we believe in all that, then the metacognitive bias is exciting because it's like, well, we know who we want to be. We want to be expansive. We want to be expressive. We want to unleash all of our potential. We want to be courageous. Okay, yeah, that's where I want to go. Cool. Yeah, I don't care if it's 12-10. I'm more willing to make this 30 points to 10 with 7 minutes to go because that's who we want to be. And that means we get players, staff who are loose. We call it, you know, wild loose. I think when I say wild, people think it means reckless, but it doesn't. Wild means on purpose and energy is in a good straight line moving forward. But that's the difference, I think, Brian. I think people people think that in performance enhancement, it's all about more detail, more strategy. And I generally don't believe it is. I generally believe it is about emotional intelligence and feeling, you know, like understanding feeling, having empathy, having identification, you know, really connecting is where them last parts of performance and potential really lies.
Yeah, so true, so true. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's... And that's what the top coaches as well. Yeah, that connection, that true connection. That true connection. That's what you're seeking as a coach, or you should be seeking as a coach. And once again, going back to the fear and controlling, and you know, talking about tactics and strategies as your number one, your number one has to be your number one tactic or strategy is, what's the tactic or strategy for everyone to connect with each other within the group, including you and the other coaches? You know, what's your strategy around that?
It's all leadership, you know. It's corporate, it's education, it's sport. It doesn't change, you know. The industry doesn't change. It's all leadership in all these areas. I'm lucky to and grateful to work with people in each of those things. And it is always the same. It is the ability to lead self, be completely connected to self, then to lead others, then to lead organization, and then to lead innovation.
That's a great point. And corporate environments, and I was in one when I was younger, 2 years in an office, and it just felt like everyone was fake in that like me too, in that like you put on this suit or you put on this shirt and pants and you go and sit at the desk, and it's like you speak a certain way, you don't say certain things. When you go out with your one friend like the kind of people you're kind of your age, you go off for lunch and then you change. You speak the way you normally speak, maybe, or you kind of you have it a crack, but once you step into that office again, you walk a bit straighter, you don't, you know, you be a certain way, and that's in authenticity. And yeah, I was doing a workshop in an office here in Christchurch before Christmas, and yeah, someone was like, oh well, a leader asked me like, oh, what if people don't, you know, it's hard to connect with them, or they don't want to open up, or they don't want to speak about anything. And then well, you mentioned there about being true to understanding self and being self, like being who you are. Like, I would, most leaders as well, if you go into an office when you're 20 and you're then 35 and you've been in that accounting office or different accounting officers or law offices for 15 years, you get conditioned on how to be as a manager in a law firm or accounting firm, whatever, you know, and you just act that way. And you then act like the traditional manager acts, and you wouldn't be, like you say, wild or like just being yourself, because that's, you then will be afraid of if someone above you would see you being that way. And the people below you, then they see you as just that archetype manager way, you know?
Yeah, it's really funny. It's not funny at all, but it reminds me of that leader you just mentioned that says, what do you do if you've got someone that doesn't open up? And this is where I always come back. They're a mirror of the leader. And it's like the leader says, oh, they don't open up. He's basically saying, look, can you open up? Because vulnerability in you is strength, but vulnerability in me is weakness. I like to see it in you, but I won't show it in me. It's basically where most leaders fall down. It's like, we want them to be more open. Where are you open? As the leader asking that question, when are you open? When are you vulnerable? When are you brutally honest or compassionately honest? When are you sharing your truth? When are you declaring what you're scared of? You know, and then they go, yeah, I don't. Well, your team's a mirror of you. So if you want them to open up, you first have to throw yourself under the bus first, and share some things, you know, to enable, you know, identification with someone, to enable your workforce to be open. And yeah, it's a funny one. I spoke to someone the other week about this, a coach. Where first of all, his first word, what's vulnerability? He couldn't even count to two, and he said weakness. And then he mentioned about how he's helping another coach, and he asked the coach to talk to him. And when the other coach gets overwhelmed and they talk it through, and the other coach gets tearful and shares, he's like, oh, it's brilliant. He's back to, you know, being himself and expresses himself more. Oh, right. Really? Okay, cool. So when are you vulnerable? Oh, yeah. You just said that you're realizing him when he's vulnerable, he's really honest. He tells you the truth. Brilliant. But you just said vulnerability was weakness. How congruent are you then as a head coach? I said, you're basically saying to him, vulnerability in you, strength. Me showing it's complete weakness. I better not show you anything. So it's how does that then run through your whole coaching staff that then runs through all of your playing staff, or in corporate spaces, how that runs through your CEO, how that runs through your senior managers, who then runs through the staff underneath that person. It's all a vibration.
Yeah. And I think, love what you said there. I think just when you were talking, something kind of landed with me in that, with this word vulnerability, I think what it kind of means is being honest and open. So and I see how some people would think how vulnerability with leadership doesn't align. And they're probably thinking that, oh, vulnerability means being a mess on the floor 24/7, you know, being unable to cope with the world. And it's like, no, and that's, I think, what some people think, but no, it's not. Vulnerability is the ability to, know what you're feeling, be connected to yourself, and then be open and honest with those around you.
Yeah, 100%. I think that is the misconception. I think people think vulnerability is sitting around, holding each other's hands, having a good, really crying everything out, you know, oversharing. Yeah. And it's not, it's honesty. It's coming into a room and going, yeah, I'm scared right now. But this is what I'm scared of. I need your help because I want to achieve this. You ready to go? You ready to go? You know, you ready to run through some walls for me or with me? Yeah, wow, yeah, I am. Cool. Because vulnerability can also look like that. Yeah, it's just shifting that perspective, I think, that the picture that's been painted of what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Chat about the work you do in schools. What do you get up to there?
Brian, yeah, I love that. It's magical. So it just started off giving a couple of masculinity talks a couple of years ago, like positive masculinity. And then that escalated into a leadership program that I wrote for 13 to 18 year olds, where each year group gets a theme that layers up over 5 years. So the 13 year olds themes all on communication and how to build effective relationships and rapport with people. Our year 10, so our 14 year olds work on inner drivers and values, that looks at where attention surplus comes from, attention deficit, how they link behaviours to needs and wants, so they can start to direct their life from that point and onwards for leaving education as well. So really, really preparing them for life after school as well. Year 11, we look at stress and anxiety, which we closely link into fear, control, the self and identity. And then the following year, we lean more into that. So year 12, so they're 16, 17 by then. They then look into habits and identity. So how they set goals, look at the identity of who they need to become to achieve those goals, and then set their strategies and habits that align with that human being. And when they leave, so 17, 18, we look at goals and how to refine focus within that period. So there's a real strong link there between the GCSE year and the year, you know, their A-levels, BTEC, sport, whatever they're covering. But more importantly, it was to run a curriculum where many schools, and not only work in the independent school circuit, they have a tagline of preparing students for life after school. And I kind of sat in that and I was like, are we really preparing them for life after school, or are we preparing them to enter education again in university or a job that requires qualifications? Because I just felt like there was a grey area there where life is very, very different from preparing people to pass exams, to go to certain, take certain routes. So I basically went away, wrote a leadership pathway program, and you know, I'm very grateful that a couple of innovative, brave, courageous schools said, do you know what, we want to give this a go. Like, that is exactly what this modern children need. Times have changed and we do need to prepare them for life after education. So they know, you know, they know who they are, how to direct their life, how to start to find a purpose that isn't vocational, what their identity is, and leave understanding how to get a real strong sense of self. Because I think they recognize that, you know, if we don't know who we are, the world is very willing to tell us who to be. And we'll lose even more sense and get further away from who we are if it's not taught to us. And I'll be honest, Brian, like, I mean, you followed me for a couple of years. It was getting to a point where I just sat there and I was working with men for a long period, and I still do, and women as well. And I thought, where can I make an incision earlier? Where can I create a big difference generationally, where we're not trying to get to late 20s, 30s, 40s, and we're picking people up trying to do this work with them? And as much as I still love doing that now and again, I just put all my energy into the independent schools and create the program to be like, okay, brilliant. Let's give this to 13 to 18 year olds so they understand and have all this emotionally intelligent knowledge to not be in a position that our generations are going through now, to try and navigate and find out who we are and how we lost it, to get back to our true sense of self. So yeah, I mean, yeah, as you can tell, you know, I light up. I absolutely love working with this age, or that age range.
Yeah, class. Kind of, yeah, very rewarding and very enjoyable, and they're often. Yeah, they often aren't beaten down by life yet.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's I just wanted to give them the tools that I've learned that I wish I knew. you know, we spoke quite a lot today, you know, about it, and I'm giving all that to them. You know, I'm giving it all to them, and you know, I'm really empowering them to not only understand themselves, but they're at an age where I don't want that squeezed out of them through other people's projections and fears and shame and control. And it's more for them to recognize it in others and then just go, ah, oh, I now see that in you. I recognize I probably can't do anything about that because of where I'm at in life. But I know that I'm not going to break who I am because you don't know who you are. And that's absolutely fine, because now I can understand you, and I don't, I haven't lost who I am. I'm not trying to chase being good enough. I'm not trying to people please. And then take that into life. So they become, you know, fathers, wives, you know, business owners, team players, whatever it's going to be, where we have a generation of highly emotionally intelligent, empathetic, compassionately driven leaders. Yeah, it's exciting. Really exciting.
Class. I could go on forever. It's a podcast number two. But thanks for your time. Been unreal. And where can people connect with you?
I am Rick Cooper, the education athlete. That is my LinkedIn and my website. And also another website, primalretreats.co.uk, where we run a leadership retreat in Northumbria and Scotland. And I also co-facilitate a retreat with the Whole Man Academy, which is a men's retreat with them guys. So you can find me on them platforms.
Cheers for listening in today. If you want to be an absolute legend, please send the pod on some friends now. You can leave a rating and a review as well on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and make sure you're subscribed so that you don't miss an episode. Unleash Your Potential is now live. This is a course I created specifically for players who want to be professionals. It's over 6.5 hours of content and goes through everything you need to know. You can get this now through the link in the podcast description. If you want to get in touch with me about anything, please do. My Instagram is @offfieldrugby or @BrianMoylett. And my LinkedIn is Brian Moylett, and you can DM me on any of those. If you're an athlete or a leader and want to work with me one-on-one to help you get where you want to go and achieve what you know deep down you can, go to my website now, offfieldrugby.com, and book a free 30-minute Zoom call. I work with sports teams over Zoom and in person, helping players access flow state, play in the zone, build resilience, increase confidence, overcome fear of failure, and on all areas of the mental game. I also work with coaches and leaders on theming for the season and building a winning culture and environment. If this sounds like something your team would benefit from, get in touch through LinkedIn, Brian Moylett, or the website offfieldrugby.com, or also my email is offfieldrugby@gmail.com, any of those. And finally, I do high performance workshops for businesses, once again, in person and on Zoom. And in these workshops, well-being is covered as well. In them, I'll show you tools to mitigate stress and pressure, teach you how to increase your focus and your attention span, give you simple strategies you can use immediately to increase productivity while improving your well-being. So essentially, you'll be feeling better, you'll get better quality work done, and you'll have more time. If you're a business leader and feel your team would benefit from this, you can get in contact through all the ways I've mentioned. My email is offfieldrugby@gmail, my LinkedIn, Brian Moylett. Thanks again to you for listening today. Really appreciate it. Be good to yourself and have a brilliant rest of your day. Cheers.